In December 2013, Egypt was a dangerous place. The country's elected president, Mohamed Morsi, had been overthrown in a military coup. Egypt's new rulers were cracking down hard on dissent, and thousands of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood had been killed. Australian-born journalist Peter Grester was in Cairo at the time, reporting on the turmoil for the Al Jazeera News Network. Then one evening, when Peter was in his hotel room, there was a pounding at the door. A group of men entered the room, arrested him, and confiscated his equipment and laptop. Peter and his friends were given a farcical trial where he and Al Jazeera were accused of collaborating with a terrorist group. They were found guilty, and Peter was looking at spending years stuck in Cairo's Toura prison. Peter's parents, Lois and Eurus Grester, were following the trial from their home in Brisbane. They and their sons, Andrew and Mike, had mounted an international campaign to get Peter's conviction overturned. For them, it was more than just a quest to save their son from prison. It was a defence of the rights to free speech. They knew almost nothing of Egyptian language and culture, but their campaign took them all the way to the presidential palace. Freeing Peter is a book that's been jointly written by the Grester family. Peter's mum and dad, Lois and Eurus, are my guests today. Lois and Eurus, hello to the both of you.
Hello, Richard.
Pleasure to be here.
When Peter became a foreign correspondent, Lois, would he be frank with you about the danger spots he was going to?
Up to a point. He would tell us usually where he was going, and of course we would follow. But I think not always did he tell us how dangerous it actually was.
In December 2013, he was more or less based in Nairobi working for Al Jazeera and brought to Cairo to work at the bureau there just temporarily. Eurus, how were you told that Peter had been arrested by the authorities there?
We got the news, in fact, via Mike.
Your son, Mike.
Yes. It was shortly after Christmas. We had had a lovely Christmas with Mike and his family in Toowoomba. We were up in the bush at our little hobby farm, just winding down, ready for New Year's Eve, and, you know, lit the lanterns and the candles, ready for dinner, and all of a sudden the telephone rings, you know, big bang. Peter's been arrested in Cairo. It was a surprise to get that sort of news, particularly at that sort of time, and yet, when we reflected, we realised that, you know, that was a risk that was always present. And although you don't sit around and wait for the telephone to ring with news that your son's been arrested, it was a big blow. But at the same time, you know, we felt that, well, these things happen to foreign correspondents and, you know, it'll sort itself out in no time at all.
What was your first instinct once you'd heard he'd been arrested, Lois?
Oh, you know, my heart sank, of course. And I guess I just wanted to pack up and go home straight away. And Mike had said that Al Jazeera were looking for us. The thing was that we had moved house. We'd sold our family home and bought and downsized and moved to there in late October. And we had just sort of settled, basically, got everything in and sorted things out. And obviously Peter hadn't updated his telephone numbers, so that's why they were searching for us everywhere.
Did you start making plans to fight the arrest?
Not quite immediately. I mean, well, when I say that, I might have only taken a day or so. Eurus was of the opinion that it'd blow over and that this was all a big mistake.
Because these things often do, don't they? They often just blow over after a couple of days.
Exactly.
Mistakes were made, off you go, scamp, don't do it again, slap across the wrist.
Yeah.
And
once
you realised it wasn't going to blow over, what then?
We just dropped absolutely everything in our lives and just set to work. We did emails to everybody we could think of, politicians, friends, any person that we thought might be able to help.
How did you divide responsibilities between you?
Well, Eurus is the writer in the family. Not, well, I wouldn't say Peter's definitely the writer. But out of the two of us, Yus is much more of a writer than I am. And I guess I'm more of an organiser. So I took up the phones and he sat at the computer and wrote.
I guess really what got things rolling was that I went through our own personal network of people who might be able to raise a level of awareness of the case. For example, I went through the list of parliamentarians, senators who I knew had an interest in human rights issues, media issues, you know, who'd kind of spoken about related matters, and just broadcast a plea as widely, as broadly as I possibly can. What we must remember is that this was at the beginning of January when Australia just about closes down. A lot of people, you know, choose not to listen to the news or read papers.
And you're trying to bang the drum, trying to raise awareness.
That's right. So, well, the major priority was to make sure that the news gets around as broadly as possible.
In essence, you're taking on the government of Egypt as a retired couple living in Brisbane. Did you have much of a background knowledge of Egypt, its culture, its language, its history? And that must have been a kind of an awesome undertaking, Lois.
We had no idea whatsoever. I think yours probably was both of us were listening to the news, because having a son over there, you sort of tend to take more interest in what's going on. But at that stage, I don't think we even thought of it as taking on the Egyptian government. You know, we just wanted Peter out of prison by whatever means.
He was put in a tiny cell with a group of other prisoners, and the charges against Peter were collaborating with a terrorist group, knowingly broadcasting false information to spread fear and discontent, with intent to destabilise Egypt and defame the government, for broadcasting without a licence, possessing equipment used to broadcast without a licence, and working as a journalist without a permit. The Egyptian government had got it into their heads that your son, Peter Cresta, was a partisan broadcaster for the Muslim Brotherhood. How seriously did you take those charges?
Oh, we thought they were rubbish. To be honest, really.
But did that give you heart? Did you think, well, the charges are self-evidently absurd, therefore he'll be released?
Yeah. Well, as soon as the charges were laid, I realised, and incidentally, they weren't charges, they were just allegations, you know, and little by little we realised that these are supposed to be charges. A lot of kind of things get confused or lost in the translation between Arabic and English.
I also think it's also their own justice system that works very differently to ours.
When I realised that they were apparently serious, I felt this is all so extreme that I needed to start recording this. This is so odd, this is so way out, that we need to tell, I guess, almost the rest of the world how strange these things can happen. Maybe it betrays how naive I am, but I truly believe that the fundamental concepts of what we refer to as natural justice apply to, you know, most modern states. And yet, here we were. It obviously didn't.
At last you were able to get him on the other end of a phone, Lois. Mm. How did he sound once you'd spoken to him that first time?
He sounded pretty good, actually, and it allayed my fears. I was obviously worried about torture and all sorts of dreadful things that were going through my head.
But he wasn't tortured?
No. He couldn't tell me much because they were listening in. He had the phone on speaker, but he kept telling us that he was perfectly okay.
And you would no doubt know, Richard, that mothers have a wonderful sense of reading voices, you know, subtle intonations in their children's voices.
No, he was fine.
There was a lot of interest building in the case in Australia, and you were asked to give a press conference, which was held right where we're sitting now, actually, in the ABC's headquarters in Brisbane. What was the message you were trying to get across at that press conference, and what kind of a fine line did you have to tread?
Well, the fine line, which we found at times difficult to tread pretty well throughout the whole of the campaign, was where to focus our advocacy for Peter as a person, our son, and where to emphasize the fact that this isn't just about Peter, or it isn't about Peter at all, but it is about media freedom, freedom of speech, freedom to report as objectively as any highly qualified and any journalist of high integrity could do.
So your hope was to encourage other journalists to step forward, to recognise the principle at stake here and engage their support and aid through
absolutely,
this.
Absolutely. And I think that was achieved because we just felt that the press were behind us all the way.
You spoke with Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. What was she able to do under those circumstances?
I don't recall that she did an awful lot at that very early point. It was later on that she really got involved. I think she too was like us, was waiting for the verdict and for it all to be over, because each time there was an adjournment, you would think, oh, well, the next one we'll have, the answer. But it just went on and on and on. I think there was 13 adjournments and trials. Mm-hmm. Before the verdict came down.
The way the trial evolved became more and more weird and bizarre and kind of, dare I say, Monty Python-esque every time.
Yeah, it would have been hilarious if your son hadn't been languishing in a prison cell, I
absolutely.
Suppose, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, Al Jazeera were under attack by the Egyptian government.
Yes.
That was Peter's employer, the Qatar-based news network. Was it managing the relationship with you and Al Jazeera a tricky thing, insofar as they were very supportive of Peter, but their interests won't always coincide with Peter's, would they?
No, it's true. But our relationship with them on a personal basis was very good. Certainly they supported us in many ways. But there were definitely differences along the way, things like when they tried to sue the Egyptian government.
That's right. Al Jazeera tried to sue the Egyptian government for damages.
That's right. For $150 million or something like that. And it came at just before the end of the trials. And that really sort of sent us rocketing to the floor.
Peter wrote at the time that his spirits were sort of very up and down. He mm-hmm. did experience protracted periods of depression and boredom, which is entirely understandable under the circumstances. Were you aware of his low spirits at times?
I think he hid a lot of those from all of us and tried to be quite upbeat all the way through. There were times I could see it when we went to visit him, that he wasn't as good as he had been. And there were days, I think, when Mike and Andrew reported that to us as well.
Yeah, both your sons took turns in going over to
yes.
into Cairo along with you to visit Peter and go and see him on a regular basis.
Yes.
How hard was it for your sons, Mike and Andrew, to just drop everything in their own lives to go over there and be there for Peter?
Our kids gave up everything to help. It was amazing. I'm starting to feel...
Well, it was almost, in many ways, looking back, everything looks different in retrospect. But the hindsight convinces me that a lot of things were very rightly, very well timed for us to engage in this operation. Andrew, who manages a big cotton farm, had actually planted a very much smaller crop than usual because they didn't have enough water. So that particular year, the harvest was going to be fairly small. Andrew had it fairly well organized, under those circumstances. And when it all happened, it just so was that Andrew was able to draw on his accumulated long service leave, which is another, fortunate turn of events.
Peter's other brother, Mike, is a police officer.
Yes.
I wonder if that training and that way of looking at the world was probably quite helpful under the circumstances too.
Definitely, I think so. Mike was the one who put his hand up first to go to Cairo. As soon as we started talking about that there should be someone over in the family, he was the one that said, I'll go. But in the end, we chose to send Andrew because his relationship with Peter was closer.
as the hearings were unfolding and the evidence was being presented against Peter, how were you following that? Was it televised, or how were you getting information from those moments?
The wonder of the Twitter world. The only way that we could actually follow fairly closely is via Twitter feeds. And, you know, every time we relied on being up to date with what was going on in Cairo on Twitter, I reminded myself how dreadful it would have been a few years ago before Twitter to keep track of what's going on.
So observers, journalists are sitting in the courtroom taking photographs and just posting it on their Twitter feed.
Yes.
As you were following it, what was the evidence like that the prosecution was bringing against Peter trying to prove a terrorist connection to the Muslim Brotherhood?
Bizarre. Absolutely
in
bizarre.
In what way bizarre?
Oh, there was one time when there was photos of Eurus and myself and Peter on holidays.
How was that
brought up as evidence?
How was that evidence of terrorism? Like, were you considered suspicious characters by the court? Is that what it was?
I have no idea.
I don't want to accuse the Egyptian judiciary of negligence, dare I say. But clearly what had happened was that instead of looking at all the available evidence, they, for whatever reason, just put everything up that was on Peter's, you know, memory stick, hard drive, in his computer. Maybe they were so absolutely convinced that if they ran through everything, you know, the right sort of condemning evidence would appear.
Let's assume that the prosecutor and the judge aren't idiots. They know this is as nonsense like you do. What's going on? Why are they presenting nonsense, and why is this nonsense even being entertained in a courtroom? Could you ever find out?
No.
But when you are dealing with extremes, I have to say one thought that flashed across my mind was, are they trying to demonstrate the absolute weakness of the case? In fact, that there is no case, you know? In other words, just showing laughable evidence to say, well, there is no case.
From my point of view, it sounds to me, which is probably completely wrong, but it seems to me that you have a new government in place. Mm. It's trying to, you know, knock everyone into line. The elements of the judiciary are trying to demonstrate their loyalty to the new government in this very transparent and hardline sort of way. And it sounds like your son got caught up in all that.
Well, I saw it as slightly different. I guess I saw it as if the judiciary and the government were actually fighting for power.
Oh, the judiciary is trying to embarrass the government,
you know, there's all ways of looking at it, isn't
there? Right. And you can't really know,
We have
Idea. Could the embassy give you good advice on that, or were they able to... They would have had more insight into the background politics, I would assume.
We developed a very good relationship with the ambassador and the consular staff. But clearly, there are things that the diplomats know that they are not able to share with us. I believe Dr. Ralph King, our ambassador, brought us into as much information as he had. But the Egyptian system is immensely complex. And following some of Egyptian politics from, you know, this far away, reading various online magazines about Egypt, clearly, even internally, you know, people don't know kind of how the system works. You know, we kept getting told that the most important thing is make sure your contacts are right. Make sure your contacts are right. We all rely on networks. But it seems that the system, the structure of governance is less important than your contacts.
Yes, yeah, so again, I say you're a really nice retired couple in Brisbane. You know, not many retirees in Brisbane have strong power, high power contacts in the upper levels of the Egyptian military, judiciary and government,
no,
do they?
No, that's right. But I think we also were very lucky and we would say that things fell into alignment because the time Peter was recognised by the Latvians as being a citizen of their country.
So the government of Latvia came to his aid too?
That's right. And that not only meant the Latvian government, but they had the presidency of the Parliament of Europe at the time. And, of course, that meant the EU formed this background as well. So we had a lot of support in that area.
So was this leading you to feel reasonably confident that when the verdict came down, Peter would be acquitted?
We were very confident.
We had a fridge full of champagne ready to go.
And what happened on the day of the verdict?
Oh.
A bomb dropped.
Yes. We had foreign correspondent there.
The ABC TV show.
The ABC TV show, who were recording it because they thought this was going to be, you know, party time too. And as it turned out, Peter got 7 years.
He and his colleagues as well. Yep.
In fact, Bahe got 10 years.
So what then? Did you collapse into a heap after that?
Not
well,
for long.
Come on. Let's face it, we did.
We did. Yeah, well, you know, there was tears and crying and couldn't believe it and all that sort of stuff. But it also, again, said, boy, this is not going to be, you know, none of us in the family would admit, would, you know, acknowledge that he would be in for 7 years. There was no way.
So you decided to go to Cairo at that point, both
yes.
of you to Cairo. Had either of you been to Cairo before?
Yes, we both were on the boat going over to England.
All right, you went up the Suez Canal.
Yeah, we went up the Suez Canal.
Nonetheless, Cairo 2013, 2014 is a different place now than it was then, I'm sure.
Vastly different. Tanks and soldiers with armed Kalashnikovs and all the rest of it.
Once you arrived there, Al Jazeera put a man named Joe at your disposal as your aide. Tell me a bit about him.
Well, Joe did everything for us. You know, he was our security, he was our interpreter. He looked after us in every way. He knew where to shop, and if he didn't know where to get things, he would, you know, find out. And
so he was street smart.
He was very right. street smart, extremely street smart, and he would guide us and support us every way. He was on tap to us 24/7.
How did you cope with the stress of modern-day Cairo?
It was hard, but to be able to cope at all, we clearly looked for moments of relief. And as much as anything else, Joe helped us find some of those moments of relief. And we did actually have some very memorable and pleasant times in Cairo.
Yeah, I mean, Ralph King and the Latvian ambassador, Verka Zulka, also were very important in helping us sort of take these times out, so to speak. And we had the support of Patrick Kingsley and Ruth Pollard from the Sydney Morning Herald. They all came and took us out to dinner or, you know, made certain that we were okay.
You were allowed to go and visit Peter in Tora prison. Tell me about going to that prison, what it looks like as you approach that prison.
We were allowed to go once every 15 days. By the time we went over, Peter was in a wing called Masra. And in that wing, you're only allowed to go once a fortnight or every 15 days. When we arrived, it was 40-degree temperatures. It was hot and dusty and quite dirty. Tora Prison is about 2 kilometres in length from the start of the one wall to the main gate. And you have to queue up to get in.
They pat you down?
Yes, they pat you down. They
see if you're carrying a file
yes,
or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, they go through all of the things that you take in because you have to take the food, anything that Peter required and needed. Everything had to be taken in. We had eskies full of, you know, food for him for 2 weeks.
What kind of food did you bring in for him?
Oh, he would make lists of stuff. We took anything that he wanted, meat and vegetables and because he likes to cook. And by then he was in a situation in a prison where he was able to do a bit of cooking. He had one hot plate and a tiny little oven about, you know, the size of a microwave.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Broadcast, podcast, and online. All our conversations are available on the ABC Radio app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you went to see Peter in prison. How did he look when you got there?
Well, he dressed himself very well. He you know, he looked after himself.
Peter, of course, had to have legal representation while he was there. Yeah. Finding a legal team sounds like it was a real business too. I mean, because it's also opaque. You know, who's telling you the truth? Who's honourable? Who's not honourable? Who actually has power and influence? Who doesn't?
Well. Who speaks English? Who had accreditation to go through the Court of Cassation? Because not all of them are able to do that.
In the end, you settled for a guy who sort of seemed to be speaking the reasonable truth to you in the end. Was that a good decision?
Look, there is so much that we don't know about the Egyptian legal system, judicial system. But I have to say that my impression is that to anybody, even a, you know, experienced Egyptian, it is all a guessing game. You know, who is the appropriate, who is the best, who has the right connections. And again, we kept being impressed that it's all about connections.
Were you looking for the conviction to be overturned or for a pardon?
Well, in the first place, definitely to be overturned. Peter was adamant that he would not come out. He needed his name cleared as far as he was concerned.
So a pardon wasn't good enough for
him? A pardon wasn't good enough. But as it turns out now, he's neither pardoned or he still has a conviction. So,
when you were speaking, how were you trying to present yourselves to the Egyptian public that might be hearing you or understanding what you were going through?
All of us kept a low profile in Egypt itself. So it was only what we did here in Australia and what some BBC, Arabic radio and TV did of us. We didn't actually do any local media over there.
Did you feel you have to, you know, pressure the Egyptian government but not be too critical at the same time?
Indeed. It was a real hairline between maintaining Peter's innocence and at the same time having to contain our rage and anger but be courteous, respectful of their system, of you know, the cultural differences.
So even though the judicial process was a travesty, it wouldn't have helped your case at all for you to say so publicly.
That's right. Exactly. That's right. Mm.
So you just had to let that pass. Yeah. That slide.
Yes.
But while we didn't engage with the Egyptian media, with you know, communications the way they are today, whatever we said here soon was picked up in Cairo.
Absolutely.
Not by the general public, of course, but for better or worse, by the people who mattered.
Mm. It was looking really bad, though. It was a bad look for the Egyptian government at that time. Mm. Your son, Andrew, was eventually given a contact with someone in the office of the president of Egypt, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, a man named Mohamed Moussa. What did that lead to?
It led to Eurus and myself getting an interview with the senior advisor of el-Sisi.
President el-Sisi.
Yes.
That took you to the presidential palace?
It took us to the presidential palace.
What was it like to pull up in front of the presidential palace in a taxi?
Well, you know, you can't compare events as to which was kind of more scary and which rattled us more. But it was quite a weird experience.
It's a bit more splendid than Torah prison, though, by the sound of things, isn't it?
Oh, jeez.
Once you met with the spokesperson for the president, what kind of message was he able to give you?
Well, I personally felt very I felt very angry at the time. I was feeling as if I could really burst out, and Eurus put his hand on my knee to calm me down.
Were you about to give a clip over the ear to the spokesperson of the president of Egypt? Okay. Free my son, please.
Yes.
But what did he put to you? Why did he want to meet you?
Well, he was very apologetic about the whole situation. President el-Sisi would like to find a way out, and whatever he could do for us to help us, he would do. And
what does
that
mean, though? He wants to find a way out. I mean, he's the president of Egypt.
I know.
Can he find a way out? I mean, and you're some nice people from Brisbane.
Yeah.
What did you take that to mean?
Look, as much as anything else, it was also a message for us to take to our government. Let's see if we can offer some arrangement, even at the government level. to find a way out.
Did you get the sense that they were trying to charm you as much as you were trying to charm them?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, in the end, we got extra visits and we got Peter's university degree papers. He started a master's degree. These papers were stuck in the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and so he managed to get those through quickly for us.
What was Foreign Minister Julie Bishop able to tell you at this time, that some kind of face-saving deal might be possible?
I think that they were certainly doing a lot of talking, and Julie Bishop's message to the Foreign Minister, the Egyptian Foreign Minister, was quite stern and, you know, let's get on with this, let's clear this up.
After that meeting at the Presidential Palace, did the quality of your prison visits with Peter improve after that?
Yeah, we had three visits in a week. We were allowed into a special room which had air conditioning and we had about an hour and a half, 2 hours. We could have stayed for as long as we were told we could stay for as long as we liked.
How was your health at this time in the heat and going back and forth between here in Cairo, Lois?
Well, I did have a couple of scares of very high blood pressure, which was only brought on by stress. I don't suffer from high blood pressure, I should say. But there were a few times that it got to me. I ended up, you know, working on myself, doing a lot of swimming and meditation.
How are you hanging together as a family, Eurus? You and your sons, your other sons, Andrew and Mike, coming back and forth between here and Cairo?
Well, the boys were realising that the stress of all this is beginning to take its toll, or certainly risking taking a toll whereby we may not be able to, you know, appropriately continue responding. So they took the, as it were, the heavy end of the campaign back home.
Back in Australia, there was a lot of support from the MEAA, the union that supports journalists, mm-hmm. and a huge event was held for you at the National Press Club. The dinner was there, and that's where you met the then Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. Mm. What was your meeting with him like?
We were invited into the boardroom, and it was cleared except for ourselves and the president of the National Press Club, and Tony Abbott was ushered in and introduced. I guess I felt as if he was really just spilling out what he needed to say. I didn't feel as if there was any connection whatsoever.
How about Julie Bishop? How was dealing with her?
Oh, she was very different. I think she was well and truly working extremely hard to get Peter released.
Dick Smith called. What was he offering?
He offered money, he offered support. We'd gone past the verdict. We had employed the lawyers, and we were looking at employing another set of lawyers, totally separate from Al Jazeera.
What was immensely heartening, which really gave us confidence to go on from this point, was that knowing that we would have to find our own lawyers and probably also meet the fees of these lawyers, Dick Smith offered to underwrite any deficiency in funds that we could not raise ourselves. We were clearly very worried how we were going to meet what looked like a fees bill of something like $300,000 at least. We clearly would have done everything possible to do that, but it might have meant, mortgaging houses or whatever.
Well, that was very kind of him then. So it was a huge weight off your mind.
It was an immense load off of our minds.
Absolutely. Yeah. It freed us up totally to feel that we could employ whoever we needed to.
So stuff was happening. I mean, you had President El-Sisi went to the United Nations, where President Obama brought up Peter's name. Mm-hmm. Prime Minister of the UK, David Cameron, brought his name up. Tony mm-hmm. Abbott spoke up for Peter at the UN as well. But meanwhile, Peter was worried that not enough momentum was happening, and so he and the other prisoners in his unit all agreed to go on a hunger strike. What was your reaction to that, Eurus?
I was dreadfully rattled, as much shaken by this threat or possibility of a hunger strike as the whole verdict itself.
So aside from it being, you know, bad for Peter's health, you just thought it was strategically the wrong move too, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes.
We, well, equal kind of weight on both of those concerns, strategy as well as Peter's health. I remember the dire outcomes of some of the hunger strikers who took it, you know, to the limit with the Irish
IRA Bobby Sands, prisoners all died.
That's right. Yeah. You don't make threats like that lightly. You know, if you undertake to do something, you carry it through. And we were almost panic-stricken that if Peter were to undertake this path, that it could lead to dire consequences.
So how did you persuade him not to do it, Lois?
Oh, we wrote long, long letters, because at the time no one was over there. And Erica Tolano, who was the Australian consul, she took those letters in, and I think we spoke to her on the phone and asked her to try and persuade Peter. But I think she expressed how concerned we were.
You were over there for Christmas in 2014, so at that point he'd been in jail nearly a year. What kind of food, Christmas food, were you able to bring for him?
Well, we arrived on the 29th of November, and it was Peter's 49th birthday on the 1st of December. And one of the things that we took over was a leg of lamb. And I had it vacuum packed and ice around it and so on. So that was very special for him, and he managed to cook it with some Australian herbs, bush herbs that we'd also given him, some lemon myrtle and what have you.
Was he able to give you any Christmas gifts?
No, but he gave us for our birthdays a very special gift that he had printed written a poem in calligraphy, and had this funny little frame around it that was almost falling apart. I don't know where he managed to get that frame from, but it was a very, very special gift, that one. There was also gifts that came from his prison cell friends to us, a card that someone had drawn and written out, and Bahir had made some coffee that he'd put special spices in. Someone had given me a flower that they'd found somewhere, somehow. I don't know how.
So you were waiting for the appeal to go through, and finally at the appeal hearing, the judge ordered a retrial, like doing the whole thing all over again.
Yes. I initially went through a bit of a phase of quick shock, but then we suddenly realised that probably that was the only outcome that they would come down with. Otherwise, they weren't saving face.
Right, so that was the only come down they could arrive at was a retrial.
Yes.
Admitting the first trial was flawed.
Yes.
And then have to go through with it again. But then you started to get wind at the end of January that something might be moving, something else might be moving.
Well, we actually got a bit of a wink and a nod on Christmas Day. The warden, who was quite friendly with us, of Peter's wing, came in and told us that Peter would be out within a week. And we thought, wow. And the three of us refused to believe it, actually.
We learned during December the president had drafted this special decree to get rid of foreign prisoners in Egyptian prisons. And while it initially looked like a kind of a general decree, rumour came through that, in fact, it was motivated by Peter's case, you know, because that turned out to be the one way of getting rid of him.
There's definitely negotiations going on between Julie Bishop and the foreign minister, the Egyptian foreign minister, how they could do this. And the decree actually said that Peter could be sent back to Australia to serve out his term or face a court case hearing here in Australia. And Julie Bishop told us that there was no law in Australia that Peter could be charged with.
They deported Peter to Australia to face trial here, but there were no laws to be
him
to be charged with.
Or that he would be imprisoned for the term of the sentence. And, of course, there was no way that Julie Bishop would put Peter into prison.
So how were you told that he was being let out?
Mike was the person who was over there at the time, was told by the ambassador that Peter would be released the following morning. He told Andrew, and they kept it a secret from us. I think they were still anxious that it wasn't going to happen. Every time we'd had so many of these, you know, possibilities that had fallen through.
So how long before they told you?
Oh, it slowly leaked out, you know. It was only overnight, you know, and the next minute Peter was out and he rang from the airport to say he was free, and they were still under the authorities of the Egyptians until they landed and got through the customs and immigration in Cyprus.
He landed in Cyprus then, that was the first place.
This final phase was really achieved through the efforts of some of the lawyers that Andrew and Michael were able to interact with.
Here in Australia,
yes. People with international law experience, human rights experience, who worked very closely with the diplomats and our Egyptian lawyer to really push hard the diplomatic channels as well as the legal channels, because without that extra, quite intense, hard pressure, I don't think it would have, we would have achieved our final result.
What then? Is there is this feeling of elation or the weight falling off you or what?
There was definitely we looked at each other and said, right, it's over. You know, it was a feeling of relief, total relief.
Anticlimax?
Anticlimax, total anticlimax. But then the climax came, of course, when he arrived here back in Australia and at the airport, it was just such an amazing scene of all these people.
The Australian journalist Peter Grester is finally home in Brisbane with his family. He spent over 400 days in prison in Egypt for doing his job as a reporter for Al Jazeera English, along with two colleagues, Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed.
I don't know how many journalists and reporters with cameras flashing, like, no idea.
This is in the middle of the night.
This was in the middle of the night, about 3 o'clock in the morning by the time we actually submerged from the back of the airport. He was ushered into a special room where the family was. And, of course, there was big hugs and rolling around on the floor with the nephews and young members of the family, and big hugs for us, of course, for all of us.
He said he'd been thinking about Australia the whole time he was in prison. He had sort of little images of Australian, I don't know, being at the beach or something, which were places he could go to in his own mind while he was in prison.
Well, our sons, Andrew and Mike, and their wives and Peter had a wonderful holiday up in the Whitsundays. One time, just before he was went to Egypt, I think it was in the August of that year, and he said that he went back to that holiday so many times.
After all this experience, you had this frustration with Egyptian authorities on the one hand. Nonetheless, with local Egyptian people, you had these wonderful experiences and you met with great kindness and loyalty and all those things. How do you guys feel about Egypt now after this whole process?
I personally feel that the Egyptian people are just wonderful people. You know, they're like us. They try to go about their own business. They're living in a rather difficult situation. I just feel that the authorities are causing the big problems for them.
I feel sad. I feel very sad for the Egyptian community. I can't help feeling it's got to break, it's got to blow again. The present state of affairs can't go on. I think too many people are having too hard a time. Freedoms and rights are being limited and prescribed all the time. Something will have to give.
Do you ever reflect on the weirdness of the experience you went through for 400 days of Peter's captivity? I mean, this is not quite what you're expecting in your retirement, is it? To be campaigning for the release of an Australian journalist who happened to be your son in Tora prison in Cairo.
It was weird. The whole 400 days were unbelievable, you know, in so many ways. What we had to deal with, the difference in culture, in language, in judicial systems, in governments, in everything, in time differences even, you know, between various countries that we were dealing with. Because we were at times in touch with England, Africa, I'm talking about Nairobi, people in Nairobi, in Egypt, America, dealing with so many people from so many parts of the world. It was just an amazing time.
It's been lovely to speak to both of you about this and to see you at the other end, smiling faces at the end of this strange and weird adventure you've been on over the last couple of years. Eurus and Lois, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.